From Mississippi to Pennsylvania, Oklahoma to Virginia, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, artificial intelligence, or AI, has been in the headlines a lot lately. From the Stargate Project to the emergence of DeepSeek, we find out what it all means from Neil Chilson of the Abundance Institute. The U.S. Senate is making progress on confirming President Trump's cabinet nominees. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth is here with the real story. A year and a half after the wildfire that destroyed over 2,000 structures on Maui, only three homes have been rebuilt. Eric Boehm and Christian Britsky of Reason Magazine are here to explain why. And President Trump has issued an executive order ending birthright citizenship for the offspring of illegal aliens. But is it constitutional? Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA has an American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Competition between the United States and China for dominance in emerging artificial intelligence technology ramped up significantly in recent weeks. For details, we turn to Neil Chilson. He is head of artificial intelligence at the Abundance Institute. Neil, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Neil, a major announcement took place a little over a week ago at the White House having to do with a project called Stargate, a big move into artificial intelligence. Fill us in on what is the Stargate project.
This project is a joint venture among some of the biggest players in the tech sector. This is a joint announcement between Oracle, which is a big infrastructure provider. They do big data centers and all the computers that people need to run algorithms on. OpenAI, which obviously is the creator of ChatGPT, an AI model, and a whole series of other products that are related to that. And then SoftBank, which is an investing company based in Japan, but one of the largest investment companies in the world. And the announcement that was made at the White House with President Trump, the three leaders of these organizations, was that they would spend $500 billion of private investment to build out the infrastructure. This is the hardware, the computers, the data centers, the big facilities that are needed to do AI research in the U.S. And this funding is all coming from private sources. This was not a government program, but Trump promised to be helping in a big way, I think, as is the way he described it, by reducing some of the red tape that's involved in generating energy, for example, that these companies would need to power these large data centers. And some of the initial building is already happening in Texas. The tranche of funds that is going out, that's committed right now, I think, is the $100 billion of that $500 billion. But obviously, this is a big project, a big investment with some big players involved.
When we talk about AI here, Neil, a lot of folks hear that term. So as we look at the Stargate project, we're going to talk about some other developments in this space as well. But as we look at all this, what do we really mean? What does it mean to the average consumer?
Artificial intelligence really is a slippery term, so it's no doubt that it's confusing to folks. In a lot of ways, you can call artificial intelligence might be more accurately called advanced computing. The definition of AI basically tends to mean whatever's at the cutting edge. AI research is whatever's at the cutting edge of what we can get computers to do. When I was a kid, first getting into computers, cutting-edge AI research was getting computers to play chess at a human level, and that was the sort of touchstone of what it meant to have a computer that was artificially intelligent. Today, we have these chatbots, these machine learning models that they do computer programming in a kind of a different way. You dump in a bunch of data, and you have the machine learn from that data rather than explicitly programming it with a set of instructions. And then it can learn to replicate patterns that are in that data. And it turns out this is very useful for creating conversations and coherent amounts of text. And so I think for the average person, what this means is that computers are increasingly easy for us to interact with in the language that we interact with other people. And so in conversation language, you know, how much, you know, thinking, and I'm putting that in air quotes, is going on behind the scenes is hard to know, really, or what does it even mean for a computer to do that? But what we do know is that they can replicate the patterns of conversation and the patterns of thinking in a way that's quite powerful and quite useful to the average person. So I think we can expect to see a lot more interesting developments in that space. Outside of these chatbots, there's lots of applications in healthcare, for instance, where we have massive amounts of data and we don't have good ways to understand what that data means. These machine learning algorithms are quite good at pulling out meaning from massive amounts of data and telling us, like, what might, for example, like, what might be triggering certain kinds of cancer? Or when I look at an X-ray, like, what might be a tumorous cell in this X-ray and what might be, you know, a healthy cell? These types of patterns are the types of things that machine learning can really help us get much better at.
Over just the past week, to many of us, a new name burst upon the scene. Now, folks like you who study this constantly, I'm sure, have heard of DeepSeek. It burst on the scene this past week, really roiled the equity markets for a couple of days. Tell us about this player, DeepSeek.
DeepSeek is a Chinese AI company. It was founded by a hedge fund, actually, in China, and it's a relatively new player to the AI markets and AI models. And what the reason that they made so much news last week and this week was that they released this new set of models. Colloquially, you could refer to them as R1. That's the primary model. And that model is open weights, which means that anybody can download this and use it. And so, and it turns out that this model is quite good. It performs at the level of some of the top models that are available right now. And it's what's called a reasoning model. I'm putting that again in air quotes, because it has an internal process of thinking that you can see where it's thinking through the problem in a way that we can see. And there's only been a few companies that have produced these types of models. Part of the reason why DeepSeek is such big news is that they did this in a way that was much more efficient than other people have done it in the past. And so they were able to do this using hardware that was older, in part because we have restrictions on what China can purchase in the hardware space. They were able to do this with hardware that was older. They still got really good performance. And a lot of this is because they were very creative in how they wrote the software to do this, to create this model. And so I think the markets reacted to that, to this efficient new model that is very powerful, and the fact that it came from China and not from a U.S. company.
We have been talking to Neil Chilson, who is head of AI, artificial intelligence policy at the Abundance Institute. And Neil, tell us a bit about the Abundance Institute. Also, give us your website, because I'm sure this conversation has probably piqued the interest of a number of folks.
You can learn more about us at abundance.institute. It's a bit of an unusual web address, but it works in any browser. The Abundance Institute is a mission-driven nonprofit that's dedicated to creating the cultural and policy environment that allows emerging technologies to germinate, grow, thrive, and prosper, because we believe that emerging technologies are the primary way to get to widespread human flourishing. And so we're very focused on AI, artificial intelligence, and energy right now, but we care a lot about a lot of the different types of emerging technologies that are going to be coming about in the next 5 to 10 years. And again, you can learn more about us at abundance.institute.
Neil Chilson of the Abundance Institute. Neil, as always, thank you for taking time to be with us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. In addition to keeping an eye on what's happening on Capitol Hill, at the White House, and around the country, Scott, it's been a sad week in the nation's capital. Terrible, tragic crash here between an airplane and a military helicopter. Appears that there are no survivors.
Unfortunately, you had an American Airlines flight coming from Wichita, Kansas, and collided with a U.S. Army helicopter, which had three of our nation's heroes on board. And the authorities have said that there's no survivors. So turned in from a rescue operation to a recovery operation this week. And obviously, there's a lot of interest in Washington, D.C. on, you know, who may have been on the flight and why it happened. There's always been sort of a controversy over Reagan National Airport as it pertains to the heavy flight traffic that comes in and out of there. And it's a constant debate among Virginia senators with really the rest of the United States Senate when it comes to how many flights are allowed and the perimeter rule and how far they can go. So I think there will be continued investigations. And, you know, coincidentally, this happened the same day that Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy was confirmed, and he jumped into action, I think, pretty quickly and, you know, worked hard throughout the night of the crash with local authorities and first responders. And, you know, of course, at Club for Growth here, we extend our sincere condolences to all the victims and their families.
As do we here at American Radio Journal, and also prayers for the safety of the first responders who are involved in the recovery efforts. You mentioned, Scott, that Sean Duffy, the transportation secretary, was confirmed this past week. A number of confirmations. Want to run through those?
Yeah, you know, and also the thing that's been sort of fascinating about these confirmations of Trump's cabinet secretaries is that most of them are getting pretty good bipartisan support. There obviously was the anomaly with that with Pete Hegseth last Friday, where he was confirmed 51-50 after Vice President J.D. Vance cast the tie-breaking vote. But aside from that, this week we've seen sort of, you know, Senate agreement in a bipartisan fashion to get a lot of these Trump cabinet officials confirmed. They came to a time agreement with the confirmation of Kristi Noem to be Secretary of Homeland Security. She was confirmed with several Democrats. Six Democrats voted for her. She got 59-34. And then the Senate moved along to the confirmation of the Secretary of Treasury, Scott Bessent, and he got confirmed with 67 votes. You know, just a reminder, there's only 53 Senate Republicans. So to get 14 Senate Democrats is sort of a big deal, right? Then you move along, and Sean Duffy, when they broke the filibuster on him, it was agreed upon 97-0, but then his final confirmation was 77-22. It seemed like there was a lot of controversy related to this executive order that the Trump administration had issued, freezing federal spending, and there was confusion among the senators on whether it applied to Medicare and Medicaid, or if it was just some of these smaller programs that, you know, really deserve investigation. I think President Trump gave a press conference this week and talked about $50 million in condoms for Hamas, of all people, and how these were being used not for sexual protection, but actually in the you know, compiling of bombs and weapons. So a lot of big stuff going on, obviously, in Capitol Hill. We also had the administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency, also known as the EPA. Lee Zeldin was confirmed with just a couple of Democrats. That one was 56-42. And we're seeing the confirmation now of the Secretary of Interior, Doug Burgum. A lot of listeners will remember he sort of looks like George Washington, and he gave it a run, sort of the college try for running for president against Donald Trump, but pretty quickly dropped out of that race and endorsed Trump and became a big-time surrogate for him. He was a former governor of North Dakota. And I think that's really what we're seeing right now is these highly qualified nominees almost coasting through the process, even if it's taking a little bit more time than the seven cabinet officials that we saw confirmed within the first 24 hours of the Obama administration. we're basically on pace to getting a dozen of his cabinet confirmed in the first 15 days of the administration. And hopefully that'll proceed to even more confirmations of some of these more lower level cabinets and, folks like Kash Patel, who he can't go through confirmation until Pam Bondi at the Department of Justice is confirmed. So there's sort of a process of Washington, D.C., and the way that the Democrats are slowing down the process has been, sort of a half-hearted attempt, if we're being honest. But it is good to see some bipartisan support. My former boss was the first senator confirmed. He was confirmed 99-0. That was Marco Rubio to be Secretary of State. And, we still do have some very, very controversial nominees as the Democrats view them when it comes to RFK Jr. to be Secretary of HHS. And also when it comes to ODNI with Tulsi Gabbard, those are going to be some nominations I think are going to really, really be a challenge to get confirmed, but we're hopeful that they get through.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, tell us a little bit about the Club.
Club for Growth is based out of Washington, D.C. If you want to learn more about our endeavor to preserve economic freedom, liberty, and opportunity, check us out at clubforgrowth.org, where you can sign up and become a member for free.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, as always, thank you for being here.
You're welcome.
If the experience of Maui in rebuilding from wildfire devastation is any indication of what to expect, those who lost homes in the current California wildfires are in for a long recovery. Eric Boehm and Christian Britsky of Reason Magazine explain why.
So as California moves on past some of those terrible wildfires in the Los Angeles area over the past month, the attention turns now to the rebuilding effort and to the long road ahead that there may be for some of those communities that were devastated by the wildfires there. To get a sense of what that road could look like, my guest today went back to what happened in Hawaii a couple of years ago, where there were huge, devastating wildfires on the island of Maui. And what he found honestly shocked me and I think will shock you as well. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. That aforementioned guest is Christian Britschke, a colleague of mine, a reporter at Reason Magazine. He was just here a few weeks ago to talk to us about the wildfires, and I had to have him back on because he's the author of a piece at Reason that you absolutely have to check out. I'm not going to give away the big punchline here by reading the headline, Christian. We'll get to that in just a second, but thanks for taking some time with us again today.
Thank you for having me back on.
So you took a look at what went on after the recovery to the wildfires in Maui from a couple of years ago. I know that California Governor Gavin Newsom has reportedly had some conversations with the governor of Hawaii, Josh Green, about that. And as you put it in this piece, if California's efforts will replicate Hawaii's, then the road to recovery will be long indeed, because Maui hasn't done much.
Right. So the Maui fires in August 2023 claimed over 100 lives and destroyed or damaged over 2,000 properties with residential units on it. The number of homes destroyed is a bit higher. And in the 18 months since, they've completed three homes have been rebuilt. Another 200 have been issued permits and about 100 are in construction. But of the homes that have been destroyed, three have been rebuilt completely. So the island still has a very long way to go towards getting anywhere near where it was before the fires.
Yeah, over 2,000 properties destroyed, only three rebuilt. I just want to underline those numbers one more time. You mentioned in the piece that all told, this was about 3% of the housing stock on Maui was destroyed in those fires. But I thought one of the more interesting things that you got into here is how, this obviously incredibly slow rebuilding process really is kind of, it stands in contrast to Hawaii's rebuilding efforts after things like hurricanes and other natural disasters, even just a couple of decades ago.
Right. Yeah. So in, a point of comparison would be a hurricane that Hawaii experienced in the 90s, where a similar number of homes were destroyed and most had been rebuilt within the course of a year. Now, there are some distinctions between the two types of disasters. A wildfire, because you have you know, kind of toxic debris is going to be more difficult to, you know, recover from in clearing the debris. But nevertheless, that's still a pretty shocking difference in how quickly it was that they were able to recover. You know, and one of the reasons, you know, my sources in Hawaii tell me is because very quickly after that hurricane, they set up, you know, private permitting office and relaxed building codes, allowing people to rebuild their homes as they were, and they issued them permits allowing them to do that. In Maui, they have very belatedly set up a private permitting office, which has sped things up a little bit. But that kind of emergency deregulation has not happened nearly to a significant degree at all. And so the process is still, you know, incredibly painfully slow.
Is it fair to say that that's mostly what's happening here? This is a regulatory and a permitting process. It's not that the people who own those 2,000 homes just decided, oh, I don't want to rebuild. I want to move somewhere else. I mean, it's the government that's holding this up.
Well, so the government is definitely holding things up. They have plenty of regulations that, you know, that already the permitting office was extremely slow in permitting new construction on Maui pre-disaster. Hawaii has probably the most regulated real estate in the country and some of the most regulated real estate in the world. Hawaii has a bunch of coastal protections, historic preservation protections, cultural protections. All of this is going to add time to issuing permits. That being said, there are other factors obviously to consider. Like I said, debris removal takes time. So that's a factor slowing things down. And then also the fact that, you know, a lot of people were reportedly underinsured on the island, meaning that they might lack the funds to rebuild their homes in the first place. But yeah, the permitting issue is a huge, huge factor here.
We're talking with Christian Britschke. He's a reporter for Reason Magazine, a colleague of mine. Check out his story that is at Reason.com right now. 18 months after wildfires destroyed some 2,000 homes on Maui, only 3 have been rebuilt. That's the headline. And of course, the thicket of red tape has been a big part of that story, as Christian explains there. You've got to sign up for his newsletter rent-free. You can find that at Reason.com/newsletters. Register for that and you get it in your inbox once a week on all the big issues in urbanism and in zoning reform and in building, all of this stuff that Christian covers for us every week and does a great job of it. Christian, just before we let you go here, I got to bring this back to California because that's where we started. And obviously that's the newsy thing here. You know, what sort of, there have been, I think, some attempts at cutting some of that red tape in rebuilding in California. More to be done still, but what is encouraging you from what you've seen so far?
Well, so the governor has waived requirements under state kind of coastal protections and state environmental law for rebuilds. The mayor of Los Angeles has issued an order, you know, attempting to expedite permitting as well. Although I'm not particularly impressed by either. Builders in Los Angeles tell me that the mayor's order will likely not do much to speed permitting. And then the governor's order basically waived regulations that were already kind of exempted fire rebuilds. So there's much more to be done. It is good at least that they're making these gestures to show that they understand red tape can get in the way, but it's an open question of whether that will actually be effective at streamlining rebuilding efforts.
Yeah, well, hopefully they do a little bit better than Hawaii does. We'll have to check in with you again on that in a few months or so. We'll see how things are going. Thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And once again, that's Christian Britschke, reporter for Reason.com. Again, check out his weekly newsletter, rent-free. Find that at Reason.com/newsletters. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
The constitutionality of birthright citizenship has become a hot-button issue in the battle to curb illegal immigration. Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA parses through the issue on this American Radio Journal commentary.
Is President Trump's executive order on birthright citizenship blatantly unconstitutional, as one federal judge has put it? Or does it simply begin a long-overdue review of a persistent misinterpretation of the 14th Amendment? The typically shallow news coverage of the legacy media propounds the notion that anyone born in the United States is automatically a U.S. citizen without exception. I would argue that such an interpretation is uninformed and that the Trump executive order is not blatantly unconstitutional at all. It may ultimately be determined unconstitutional, but it cannot be dismissed as blatantly so. It's a much narrower case. The conferring of citizenship upon birth within the territorial limits of the United States is specifically limited in the language of the 14th Amendment by these words, and subject to the jurisdiction thereof. At the time of the debate and passage of the 14th Amendment, there was a question of whether the children born here of freed but foreign-born black slaves were citizens by virtue of their birth within our borders. That was the primary purpose of Section 1 of the amendment when it was written just after the end of the Civil War. While there has been considerable debate about the original meaning of the phrase "and subject to the jurisdiction thereof," there can be no debate that the phrase sets forth an exception to birthright citizenship. It is not universal. That can be agreed upon without necessarily deciphering what the phrase itself means. The scope of the 14th Amendment was not interpreted by the U.S. Supreme Court until 1898, and the issue at hand in that case did not address the citizenship of a child of a parent illegally present in the United States, for the simple reason that there were no laws broadly prohibiting immigration at that time. Therefore, the phrases illegal immigrant or undocumented immigrant simply did not exist when the Supreme Court ruled in that 1898 decision. It is intellectually dishonest to claim that the 1898 decision ruled definitively on an issue that did not even exist at that time. The hysterical howls of outrage from the left claim that the purpose of the Trump executive order is ultimately to overturn the 1898 decision or even the 14th Amendment itself. That's not the case. They can both stand unchallenged by this executive order. What needs to be addressed now is whether birthright citizenship automatically attaches to children born here to a mother who is illegally present in the U.S. at the time of birth and whose father is also not legally present in this country. What should be sought is a clarification of the amendment's application to a situation which did not exist in 1868 or 1898. Notice the title of the executive order. It is Protecting the Meaning and Value of American Citizenship. It doesn't state or imply that any constitutional precedent should be reversed. The executive order does not challenge the original text of the amendment or the 1898 decision. Here is a key portion of the text of the executive order. It is the policy of the United States that no department or agency of the United States government shall issue documents recognizing United States citizenship when the mother was unlawfully present in the United States and the person's father was not a United States citizen or lawful permanent resident at the time of birth. Nothing in this order shall be construed to affect the entitlement of other individuals, including children of lawful permanent residents, to obtain documentation of their United States citizenship. I urge the listeners to American Radio Journal to see through the misinterpretations of the anti-Trump forces who base their opposition on something other than the clear language of the executive order. It deserves an honest interpretation by the Supreme Court. This has been Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring for American Radio Journal.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WNMB AM and FM in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, along with KZUL FM in Lake Havasu City, Arizona. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.